Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzschrauber. On today's show, digital free speech, in particular, online free speech that is about politics. This is a particularly good topic to be discussing now as the election season ramps up. And what are the laws and regulations that govern online speech? Joining me to discuss this is Commissioner Lee Goodman of the Federal Elections Commission. Commissioner, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me.
So with the creation of the internet, of course, and Web 2.0 and user-generated content, it became really easy for people to go on Twitter, go on Facebook, and vent about politics. And it was an empowering thing. You didn't really have to have millions of dollars to get your message out on television. You could just do it from the comfort of your home, easily on your cell phone. But it didn't necessarily have to be that easy. And in 2006, the Federal Election Commission made a decision that was really important in this regard. Can you explain what the 2006 rule was and how critical that was to enabling political speech on the internet?
Sure. Before I address the 2006 rule, I'd like to give you a little history.
Absolutely.
In the 1990s, as this new technology, this new medium of communication evolved called the internet, the Federal Election Commission found itself scratching its head, like many other regulatory agencies. The internet so transformed communication, association, and other realms of human endeavor that many regulatory agencies found this new technology stressed and strained their old regulatory paradigms adapted for a physical world. So in 1998, the commission was confronted with an advisory opinion request that really forced it for the first time to question how it might go about regulating communications over this new medium. There was a gentleman named Leo Smith. Leo Smith was a Democrat in the state of Connecticut. He knew how to build websites. He was one of the first wave of website builders. And he was upset with Republican efforts to impeach President Clinton. And so he started his own website that encouraged citizens of Connecticut to defeat Nancy Johnson, who was the incumbent Republican congresswoman at the time in Connecticut. And all of a sudden, people claimed, well, you were communicating on your website. You violated the law. You might have to pay a penalty. You know, knowing and willful violations of the campaign finance laws are criminal. You could go to jail. So Leo Smith came to the commission and said, what are my rights to build a website and talk about Nancy Johnson? And the FEC struggled with it and decided at first blush that they would regulate websites. And they would force little Leo Smith to account for the cost of his computer, the cost of his internet connection, the cost for any web hosting fees that he paid. Any production cost and software that went into building that website would be counted as expenditures regulated by the Federal Election Commission.
And those are the types of things that we would probably traditionally associate with a direct mail campaign, television ads, the more traditional campaign infrastructure pre-internet that you would, in theory, the political parties, Republicans and Democrats, were well-equipped to handle, well-equipped to deal with all of that bureaucracy. But here was an instance where just some guy who made a website, and you know, in 1998, it was very easy to make a website. It's still very easy to make a website. He's now being treated almost like a business, and he probably wasn't really prepared for that.
Most citizens weren't. It was the case of square peg, round hole.
Right.
And that's what the internet, you know, has done. It has transformed old regulatory regimes and defies old regulatory regimes. Now, not that the regulatory regimes should necessarily be adapted. What the internet does is it challenges old paradigms and justifications for regulation in the first instance. So, fast forward through the early 2000s, the commission soon realized it had a problem on its hands. The Leo Smith advisory opinion soon became, or it was acknowledged, became unworkable, impractical, and highly unpopular. It also proved to be indefensible paradigmatically or philosophically. Because these were all fixed costs of Leo Smith. On his kitchen table, he had a personal computer that he used for so many other purposes. And the incremental cost of using that fixed asset to build one website to communicate for political purposes, there was no measurable or discernible cost to doing so. So the commission undertook a rulemaking first in 2002, where it said it would exempt all internet communications from regulation. A federal court struck that as overbroad. So the commission went back to the drawing board. And in 2005 and 2006, the commission received over 800 comments, held public hearings, thoroughly discussed and analyzed these issues. And it developed the rule that is on the rule books today in the Code of Federal Regulations. And it is a rule that says this: the Federal Election Commission will regulate only paid ads on the internet. That is the one real-world analogy, or the old broadcast ad analogy, where you're paying a third party to advertise on the internet. That's no different than when you take out an ad on CBS or you buy inches in the Washington Post to run an ad. Beyond that, the commission said, we will not regulate groups and individual citizens' ability to communicate freely on the internet because it is a no-cost or a low-cost medium of communication. And the FEC does not exist to regulate speech for the sake of speech. We don't regulate speech because it's effective, because it reaches large audiences. None of those are justifications for regulating political speech. The only writ that the Federal Election Commission has at all to regulate political speech is to regulate large, potentially corruptive expenditures for speech.
And that's a really important point, because the First Amendment, you know, backtracking now over 200 years, it's my understanding in this country that while free speech generally protects all types of speech, there's a particular interest in protecting political speech. And that was probably the number one thing on the minds of the founders when they were writing the First Amendment. It wasn't necessarily to protect people's right to tell a stupid joke or whatever. Maybe they weren't super funny guys. But while the First Amendment does protect all kinds of speech, I think there's a particular premium on political speech. That was the real goal. So listeners might be asking themselves, why is the FEC getting involved at all in political speech if we have this idea that political speech is extra important? And that goes back to Watergate. So that's why we even have to create this situation where a campaign ad on the internet that's paid is going to be regulated like a campaign ad on the internet. And can you just go back a little bit to why the FEC came about in the first place and what the environment was like pre-Watergate?
Sure. You make a good point, Evan. Political speech is at the core of the protection of the First Amendment. We're not talking about the fringes of the First Amendment. We're talking about the core. And it is the first amendment in the Bill of Rights for a reason, because all of our other rights depend on the first right. So actually, the regulation of political spending goes back a little over 100 years to the reform era and Teddy Roosevelt, where the Congress decided that a few large monopolistic corporations had undue influence in the political sphere, and that they were giving large contributions to the major political parties. And so large corporations were prohibited from giving contributions to candidates. That was extended to labor unions in the 1940s, and it existed largely until the 1970s, when an all-new regime was put in place under the Federal Election Campaign Act and its major amendments of 1974. And it was the 74 amendments to the Federal Election Campaign Act that created the Federal Election Commission. Among other restrictions, in addition to limits on contributions, the new law placed limits on how much people could spend to speak, even independently, and how much campaigns could raise and spend to speak. All of those limits went to the Supreme Court. And we received a seminal opinion of the Supreme Court in 1976 called Buckley v. Valeo. And Buckley v. Valeo continues to animate our jurisprudence and understanding of First Amendment rights in the campaign finance world today. What the Supreme Court said was, your ability to spend money to communicate necessarily implicates profound First Amendment rights. Government has a compelling governmental interest to restrict the spending that buys speech solely for one reason, and that's to prevent corruption of candidates. So the court upheld contribution limits to candidates and upheld the restrictions on corporations and labor unions' ability to donate money to candidates. The court also upheld the restrictions on expenditures by corporations and labor unions, and that was in 1976, but the Supreme Court eventually struck that limit on independent expenditures by corporations and labor unions because the court determined that just because you and I associate and incorporate our association, we don't shed our First Amendment rights. That's the fundamental holding of the Citizens United decision.
Yeah, and that's a very, very big case, and it's constantly being criticized by skeptics of the decision who say it's, you know, enabled this flood of money and super PACs and it's enabled all sorts of corruption. But the basic premise of that decision in the First Amendment context is that if you spend money to put an ad on television to say, I like this candidate or I don't like that candidate, and you don't actually work for the campaign and it's not being given directly to the campaign, money is a vehicle for speech.
It is a resource that enables speech.
Right.
But let me bring us back then to the internet. Because those people who complain about large corporate expenditures, and by the way, you should note that the expenditures that have been freed up by Citizens United are competitive on the left and the right of the political spectrum. No side has gotten out in front of the other in total resources spent in campaigns since 2010. But to the extent people are concerned about large expenditures by nonprofit corporations, business corporations, and labor unions to urge them to vote one way or the other, we come back to the internet, which is one of the principal antidotes to big corporate and wealthy speakers flooding the marketplace, because the internet and its architecture is democratic. And it promotes low-cost speech to compete with well-funded speech on an even playing field on the internet. What goes viral on the internet often is not well-funded speech,
right?
What goes viral on the internet is often very interesting speech. Sometimes it's a homemade video or a very low-cost video posted on YouTube. People find it interesting, it resonates, and people talk to one another by sending a link or a tweet to that video, and it goes viral and gets seen by millions of people. And so what the internet and what the freedom exercised under the 2006 internet rulemaking has done is it has given life to populist voices on the level playing field. And that's why I in particular am very keen to defend the freedom that was adopted in the 2006 internet rulemaking.
Yeah, and just look at this year as an example. I mean, after 2010 with Citizens United, the refrain was that wealthy corporations would just buy every single election. And I can sympathize with the concern at the local level that a super PAC could come into some tiny town of 2,000 people and just, you know, take over the airwaves. Okay, that's understandable. I'm not sure how much of an effect that would have. But if you think about this year, what is the big story about money in politics this year? It was that Jeb Bush got $100 million. He could buy out all the TV ads he wanted. He could flood the airwaves, traditional legacy media. And it didn't matter because Donald Trump could go on a television show for free, and then that clip goes viral, and then it gets shared on the internet a million times. It was earned media. And that's what the internet allows, and it allows micro-targeting. If you only have $5,000, $10,000, you can still find out who I need to target to see this. I could even say, I want everyone that works at the Federal Election Commission to see my ad, and they could probably figure that out. So it's gotten very sophisticated, and there's plenty of confirmation bias. If you're worried that people are going to flood you with opinions you don't like, you can easily just go on Facebook and say, I don't like this, I don't want to see it. So there's some user empowerment, and the internet operates very differently than spending millions of dollars to run ads in the New York television market. So I think it makes perfect sense that in 2006, the commission realized, wait a second, you know, running an ad on Facebook is not the same as spending $1 million on to run an ad on the evening news.
You know, this election cycle has been a case in point for how low-cost communication on the internet has allowed people to not only exercise their free speech rights, but their free association rights, and allowed people to compete with the big corporate media who have historically had a monopoly over what you hear about politics. But look what else it did on the Democratic side of the fence. It empowered and supercharged a populist campaign by Bernie Sanders, who, using the power of the internet, he was able to raise over $100 million in low increments. Usually, I think his number was an average of $27 per contribution. Barack Obama, when he ran for re-election in 2012, raised over $250 million in low, less than $100 increment contributions, using the power of the internet to raise money and build associations of people. Now, we need to embrace and encourage that type of technology that empowers citizens and empowers them relative to large corporate media and large corporate expenditures in politics. And that's why this 2006 rule is so critical, and we need to maintain and build upon and expand the freedom. Unfortunately, where there used to be a consensus around this 2006 rule and the robust freedom that it afforded American citizens, the consensus has frayed. And we are looking at a 3-3 divide. We're a six-member commission. By law, it requires four votes to take any regulatory action or issue any interpretation of our laws.
So you need at least, in theory, if all three members of one party have a really great idea that they want to push through, they need to convince at least one of their colleagues from the other side, which is in contrast for listeners of this show. We are often talking about the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. Those agencies can be completely rubber stamp whatever the president wants in a lot of cases, because the president is allowed to make, whoever holds the presidency, that party has a 3-2 majority in a lot of regulatory agencies. But for, I think, obvious reasons, winning elections, you don't want one party to gain too much control. The FEC is set up in a way that you have to convince at least one of your colleagues from the other side of the aisle that your rulemaking is a good idea.
If you're going to regulate political speech and political competition, you have to do it in a bipartisan way.
Right.
And that's how and why the commission was created in 1974 to be a six-member body with a statutory requirement that it takes four votes to take any regulatory action.
And where is the future going now? So you say that the consensus is frayed. I guess it's fair to say up until recently, people were okay with the 2006 law regulation. They saw the good that it led to. What's going on now? Why the change?
I believe you can read the statements issued by my colleagues explaining why they're taking some of the votes that they're taking. But in two matters now, we have divided our votes 3-3 around YouTube videos posted for free at no charge by people. One was a group about a year and a half ago called Checks and Balances, a group that posted YouTube videos at no charge to disseminate them. And I had my two Republican colleagues and I voted to enforce the 2006 rule and said that the YouTube videos were posted for free and therefore they were not regulated by the FEC. There was no large expenditure to disseminate these videos, so we aren't the speech police, and there's no expenditure to regulate. However, three of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle voted to find a violation or reason to believe there was a violation and to open an investigation into the group for posting free YouTube videos. 2 weeks ago, we had another vote where we divided, we dismissed the case. But when we proposed to dismiss it on the grounds, and again, involved YouTube videos, we proposed to dismiss the case on the grounds of the internet regulation. Our three colleagues would not go along with that rationale for dismissing the case. And so we divided 3-3 on the statements of rationale. We have to issue statements of reasons explaining why we take the actions we do. And they would not sign on to a statement of reasons that said this YouTube video was exempt from our regulation. So we've had this growing divide, and I can only speculate that my Democratic colleagues are concerned that the internet exemption is giving rise to more sophisticated groups using the internet, and they want to begin looking at things like the back-end production cost of a video posted on YouTube. But the commission hashed all those issues out in 2006 and said, we're not going to look at the production costs. If so long as it is disseminated for free, that is the trigger for regulation.
Now, and I'm thinking here that YouTube, there's a reason that YouTube is the focus, right? Because if you even go back to 2006, Web 2.0 was in its nascent stage. You had Facebook invented in 2004, Twitter in 2008. This whole user-generated content where platforms would be created as largely neutral platforms where anyone could say whatever they want on them. And then they also have a paid component for advertising, like on Facebook and Twitter. That was still in its baby stage. And maybe that's why the FEC kind of just said, whether it's on YouTube or whether it's on some tiny little page somewhere that no one's ever heard of, it should be treated the same, because you mentioned the democratic architecture of the internet. Now, it seems like the FEC is particularly focused on YouTube, because what we see in other areas of regulation on the internet, that you become a victim of your own success. And regulators start to say, you know, that YouTube, that looks a lot like a television station. You know, that YouTube's becoming real influential. And look at these well-produced videos that people, oh man, that one was really good. It got 3 million views. Who's behind that? It's almost like regulation by raised eyebrow. We've used that phrase before, where because YouTube might be the most successful purveyor of video, although Facebook's giving them a real run for their money these days, that they become, they start to be seen as utility. And then that's where they invite regulation, and that's where your colleagues might be getting involved. It seems like it's no accident that it's YouTube and not some guy in his garage, the gentleman you mentioned earlier from 1998. They're viewing these things differently now, where in the past, because it was all on the internet, it was all treated the same.
I think that's implicit or even explicit in some of the statements of reasons issued by some of my colleagues. And particularly, you can look at the statement issued by one colleague in the Checks and Balances MERV a year and a half ago, because the group that posted on YouTube was called Checks and Balances. I think that what has caught their eye is that the internet speech has become quite effective. But I want to repeat a point I made a minute ago. We have no writ to regulate speech just because it's effective. The only writ we have is to regulate it if a large expenditure funds its dissemination.
How large?
We can require you to disclose what we call an independent expenditure, an expenditure that expressly advocates the election or defeat of someone, at $250.
Yikes.
Now, that has never been adjusted for inflation over many years. But in the case of a YouTube video, the dissemination is absolutely free. Now, there may be people who are behind the production, people who create the video, but as you know, you can take a high production video and post on YouTube and it might get very little viewership.
We know very well, because our issue area is often very wonky and it's tough to get people jazzed about tech policy issues, so there's a real challenge there. And we are often beat out by low production cat videos. So, it's going back to the point you made earlier, high production value, you know, sophisticated firm, that is not a guarantee that your video is going to do well. And for television, it is kind of a guarantee. If you have the money, you can buy the ad space, but not on the internet. You cannot force people to sit there and watch it.
It is an opt-in technology.
Yeah.
And what's going viral and what a lot of people are looking at fundamentally is interesting content that they opt to see. And that is the purest form of free speech. When you post a message and I choose to read it and I choose to share it with someone else, it is a populist phenomenon of people talking to people. And government, in addition to the First Amendment protection for that pure speech, government has a choice. Government can embrace and encourage this free speech, or government can throw roadblocks and hurdles and restrict it. And in 2006, the commission took a very distinct turn. It said, we are going to embrace and encourage this new medium and the free speech that it empowers. And I have been neck deep in a battle at the Federal Election Commission to preserve that freedom that the commission adopted a decade ago.
And what does preservation look like? So talking about the future, and you're concerned that the 2006 consensus is fraying. This kind of might be depressing, but is preservation just 3-3 deadlock? I mean, is a Federal Elections Commission that is 3-3 with three Democrats and three Republicans, even if this becomes just like every other area of our politics, super polarized, everyone digs in and doesn't want to move an inch, is that actually good because it's been set up in this way where you need to convince one of your colleagues? So, I mean, if we like the status quo, and we've talked about the status quo on the show now, can listeners take comfort knowing that at least if you and your two Republican colleagues hold their ground, this won't change?
Because it requires four votes of the commission to take action, we can hold the line. I often liken the three Republicans in this subject to having our finger in the dike. But we do. We have our finger in the dike. And there is legislation pending on the Hill to turn the FEC into a 3-2 organization.
Ooh.
And to give the White House appointment power over a so-called nonpartisan member, an independent. So there would be two Republicans, two Democrats, and one nominal independent.
Oh, yeah. So, of course, the president would go out of his or her way to make sure that this is a true centrist and not someone who can just be their patsy. I mean, come on.
Well, I'm not calling anybody a patsy, but let me just say, right now, the makeup of the commission is three Republicans, two Democrats, and one commissioner who does purport to be an independent. Now he is a good man, and I get along with him quite well. But philosophically, you need to look. He was brought to the commission as the nominee of Senator Harry Reid.
Right.
And he caucuses with the two Democratic commissioners, and he votes more often than not with the Democratic commissioners.
So you already kind of have an idea of what a quote-unquote independent would look like.
If I were to step down from the commission tomorrow, you could see what the commission would look like with an independent, and Commissioner Walter will be the chair next year. Now, as I say, I want to be clear. He's a good man, and I get along with him quite well. But you do need to look at that makeup of the commission in order to assess the legislation that certain senators on the Hill have proposed to remake the commission. So we have our finger in the dike, and it's not just the internet that's at stake. However, I should say, it's the free press rights more broadly than just your ability to publish online. Congress wrote in the Federal Election Campaign Act a press exemption, and it is related to the internet exemption because many bloggers, for example, consider themselves the new democratic press. The personal computer and the internet placed a printing press in the hands of every citizen. And some use it regularly and publish regularly, and some have built blogs from their kitchen tables to have very robust followings. And they have challenged some of the large institutional press. So if you cannot rely on a broad, clear, robust internet protection or exemption, you may then try to rely on the press exemption that was written into the law in 1974 by Congress. But increasingly, we are having 3-3 splits on the meets and bounds of the press exemption, even though it is in the statute. And Congress made clear when it wrote it into the statute that they were merely adding a statutory buttress for the free press clause of the First Amendment.
Now, I'm trying to think about what the effects would be of that change. And what it sounds like to me, which is so often the case with regulation, is that if the press exemption were to be narrowed, and bloggers, people like myself, I do this podcast, we are not treated as media anymore. We are treated as something else. Would that not just have the effect of helping the incumbents, helping the traditional media who are obviously going to have the exemption, like the New York Times, CNN? These are not going to be re-examined. No one's going to say, oh, is the New York Times actually a media organization? But, some guy who's gotten 5,000 people to read his blog per month, that guy might lose his exemption. And would this not just have the effect of cementing established media interests, the same people you talked about as having a monopoly in the 70s and 80s on television? I mean, that sounds like a regression to a handful of deep-pocketed corporate media interests being able to control the situation, and then mom-and-pop blogs are treated as something else.
You raise an excellent point. And yes, I think that is the threat. Large institutional press have not taken a threat to free press rights at the FEC very seriously, because I think they feel very secure in their position as the institutional press and take comfort in just the general notion, well, no one will ever touch me.
If I've got a seat at the White House press, like that's kind of my guarantee. Like that's my golden ticket.
So for example, about 2 months ago, we had before us a filmmaker. Let's call him even an independent fringe filmmaker. Highway 61 is a established documentary filmmaking producer in California, run by a man named Joel Gilbert, and he makes fairly exotic documentary films about exotic subjects. And he made and distributed a film highly critical of President Obama leading up to the 2012 election. And there was a complaint filed against Highway 61 Entertainment for distributing this film. The commission divided 3-3 on whether he was protected by the press exemption. Back in the 1940s and 50s, the Supreme Court had a series of cases where they held filmmakers are every bit a part of the press as a printer, newspaper, or broadcasting station.
And that's pretty forward-thinking for the 40s and 50s when the average American did not have a filmmaking capability, where now every single person with a cell phone has a filmmaking capability.
Right. So, at low cost production, he was able to produce a film, and then he received funding, as every filmmaker does, to help disseminate and market that film. The commission divided by a vote of 3-3 on whether Little Highway 61 was protected from regulation under the press exemption. Now, I issued a statement in that case, and I made the point that large institutional press should be concerned about the commission's treatment of Little Highway 61. And lo and behold, about 2 months later, we had a case involving Fox News that was released just about 2 weeks ago.
So basically like the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of large...
corporate institutional press.
Right.
Fox News hosted a presidential Republican primary presidential debate last August. And exercising their newsroom editorial judgment, they decided to expand their debate format from the planned 10 candidates, the top 10 polling candidates, to create an undercard debate format.
Right.
And they at first said, well, we want to provide our viewers, the citizens of America, access and information to more candidates than just 10. Now, that's a wholly constructive newsroom editorial decision. They established a criterion that said we will put every candidate who polls at 1% or more on that debate stage. And 2 weeks out, they decided, you know what, we're going to expand it even further. We're going to include on that debate stage, on that undercard debate, every candidate who is regularly questioned in national pollsters' polls, because national pollsters are asking questions about people that they deem important, that they're getting some response to. So that ended up adding 7 candidates to the undercard debate. Jim Gilmore, Carly Fiorina, Lindsey Graham, they got a chance to make their case to the American people. And as part of the news programming, Fox News got to show viewers more information about more candidates.
Yeah, and I would just note that the other networks that carried debates ended up doing the exact same thing, because it was such a diluted field. There were so many Republicans running for president. And just because a couple people in the lead had, you know, maybe 10-15%, they didn't want to shut out everyone, because as this election year has shown, anything can happen if you give someone a platform to speak.
By giving Carly Fiorina a platform on that undercard debate, Carly Fiorina generated a lot of buzz for her performance. She was broadly declared the winner of the undercard debate.
And then she upgraded for the next one.
Yeah. CNN then recognized the newsworthiness of Carly Fiorina. And what they did to their debate was they just added an 11th podium to give Carly Fiorina a spot with the other 10 gentlemen on the stage.
Right.
So this is wholly constructive exercise of newsroom judgment and editorial judgment. And yet when it comes to the commission, there are two votes not just to find, there are, excuse me, there are three votes on the commission to find that Fox News violated the law, made an illegal, in-kind corporate contribution to the candidates who made it on the debate stage. Two of those three voted to proceed to punish, to penalize Fox News. Now, one commissioner had the good judgment not to vote to punish, but wanted to exercise prosecutorial discretion to dismiss. Now, I ask publishers out there, how much comfort does that give you knowing that you're violating the law and in the prosecutorial discretion of six unelected FEC commissioners you must trust? So I raise this point to show you that the First Amendment rights of Fox News have great implications for the First Amendment rights of the blogger who is sitting at their computer at home, publishing content, or little Leo Smith who wanted to build a website and encourage the people of Connecticut to vote against Nancy Johnson because he didn't want any continuing efforts to impeach President Clinton. And this is the choice we have today. We can either recognize and embrace free speech on the internet and its wholly constructive democratic effects, or we can start regulating it, impeding it, and discouraging it, and causing everyone who wants to communicate on the internet to look over their shoulder and decide, am I going to be punished by my government for speaking freely on my home computer?
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be a formal rule to have a chilling effect. I mean, all it takes is for the chairman of the Federal Elections Commission to write a letter to some guy inquiring about whatever, and that could have a chilling effect. Government looking at things is not a benign act. And we talk about that on the show all the time when it says, oh, all we're doing is gathering information. We just want to see what's going on. And you just tell us what the business model is, and then we can look at it. That's not benign. That scares people. And if it can happen to Fox News, you know, who's got Rupert Murdoch in charge and like so much money, total cash cow, it can easily happen to a blogger. And who's in a better position to fight that back? So we should really be thinking about in the lens of that small blogger. Anytime we talk about regulating speech, it should be in the lens of the least resources and the smallest guy, right? Because we want that person to be protected. And then naturally, if you get that question right, it should scale up. And just to illustrate how absurd the Fox News thing is, we're talking about Fox. Fox News was being accused of unfairly helping people who were in an undercard debate. Like, this is not like Fox News unfairly helped Jeb Bush, who already had $100 million. This is Fox News, really, what an in-kind contribution to Rick Santorum. That really took him far. And Lindsey Graham, yeah, everyone still remembers that he ran for president. I mean, come on. Like, if anything, these in-kind contributions were helping people who otherwise wouldn't have had anything. So they were actually being very egalitarian in their approach to the presidential debates. Now, before we go, I just want to talk about the private sector a little bit, because we've mostly talked about the government's role. But of course, when people talk about free speech, they often think about things like, I have a right to use Facebook, I have a right to use YouTube. They might forget that those are private companies that have their own First Amendment rights over their platforms. But of course, the First Amendment is not just a law. It's a principle. Free speech is a principle. And we, I think, as citizens, are right to hope and expect that private companies do uphold free speech in their own dealings and do kind of respect that value, even if it doesn't mean a legal question. So let's talk about Europe, right? Europe is very different than the United States in that they have, you know, quote unquote, free speech, broadly speaking, so to speak, but they don't actually have the First Amendment on the books the way that we do. And that's why you end up with hate speech laws and things like that. So recently, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Twitter all signed an agreement with the European Union. And that actually is a law. It's going to require the company to review flagged hate speech and potential terrorist propaganda. Do you think something like that would be appropriate in the United States? And do you worry that because Europe is such a large market, it's part of the Western world, it has a lot of influence on issues like this, that could trickle outward and the United States could be really a lone wolf when it comes to not regulating hate speech at the government level?
Well, one aspect of our Constitution that is unique and makes us uniquely American is the First Amendment. And the European countries do not have constitutions that include a First Amendment and the freedom of speech. So what the European Union has demanded of some of these platforms, these speech platforms, would be, I think, patently unconstitutional in the United States. And government has no power to regulate speech for the sake of speech or to demand certain platforms carry certain speech.
Or not carry certain speech.
Or not carry certain
In this
speech.
Case, yeah.
And so, yes, these platforms and companies you've discussed, in my judgment, they have a First Amendment freedom to determine for themselves what the standards are going to be for speech and what they will carry and won't carry. And citizens have the right to choose to use that platform or not. They are not public utilities. The government does not own them. And just because the ones you've mentioned are perhaps the most used, does not restrict or does not limit their First Amendment freedom just because a lot of people choose to use
right.
it. Now, I would hope that they would make their standards quite clear for people so that people could choose to opt in or opt out of their platforms. But ultimately, government has no role to police the speech, either by citizens using these platforms or by these platforms deciding on the rules of engagement for people who use their platforms.
And we'll see what comes of that agreement and whether there will be calls in the United States to do something similar, because there is obviously a lot of concern about the success that terrorists have had using the internet to recruit. But of course, any discussion of limiting speech must take into account the First Amendment, at least when we're talking about the United States. Any parting thoughts before we end the show?
No, just that I appreciate what you're doing here. You're disseminating my viewpoint. I appreciate you doing that.
Happy to do so.
And I all I can tell you is I will redouble my efforts where I sit at the Federal Election Commission to protect First Amendment and American citizens' right to use this new magical technology called the internet.
And this doesn't count as an in-kind contribution, right, to you?
I'm not running for anything.
Thank you for clarifying. Well, that's it for today's show. My guest has been Commissioner Lee Goodman, who is a commissioner on the Federal Elections Commission. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an honor.
Evan, thank you for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think of the show, topics you liked, guests you want to hear again. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.